down, and we're continuing this item. At this stage, we will look at public comments, and I have had previous requests for extra time, which I will honor. Those requests were made prior to Monday noon. And so I will start with Ms. Abby Taylor Silva, who had requested 10 minutes. And we have our timekeeper on over there, 10. Thank you.
How many cards do we have, Jean-Pierre, total?
Kind of. Oh, there, it's better. Okay. Abby Taylor Silva with the Grower Shipper Association of Central California. Today, I thank you to the board for the opportunity to publicly comment on the August 2016 revisions to the MRPs. Our organization and the Grower Shipper Association of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo, who I'm speaking for as Claire couldn't be here today, we together represent over 500 growers, shippers, farm labor contractors, and supporting agribusiness. I also am speaking here today on behalf of the Monterey County Farm Bureau, which we have a lot of overlapping members, but they do have about 700 farmer members in our valley. Our members grow diverse field and nursery crops, such as broccoli, strawberries, vegetables, and wine grapes, as you know. And we're concerned that if upheld, the August 2016 MRP revisions will have a lasting impact on the ability of farmers to grow safe, healthy produce on our Central Coast and support vibrant communities. In the simplest of terms, the revised 2012 MRP orders using delegated authority without providing for an opportunity for public comment before issuing the revised MRP. Because of our significant concerns, we and other partners did file a petition with the State Water Board to challenge the issued order. However, we put the petition in abeyance so that we could have this opportunity before you to explain our concerns. And we ask that you direct the executive officer to withdraw the August 22, 2016 MRPs and revert to the previous MRP requirements. We further ask that any future revisions to the MRPs be done openly and publicly through the public process for amending the current ag order, which will include public comments, outreach meetings, and a public board meeting. So my comments today are going to focus on the following points. One, concerns with public process. Two, addition of neonicotinoids and additional pyrethroid sampling events. And I'm actually going to let my partner, Perry Clausen, speak to the groundwater sampling requirements. So first off, we're concerned that in adopting the revised MRP orders, the Central Coast Water Board failed to comply with statutory notice and other procedural requirements. Specifically, the board engaged in insufficient notice and comment procedures related to the revisions adopted in the revised MRP. Petitioners were not given an opportunity to timely raise the substantive issues and objections in this petition before the executive officer. Sufficient notice to allow for the submission of written comments, testimony, or other materials was not provided before the adoption of the revised MRP. The revised MRP contains new requirements that have not been subject to public comment or review, are the first of their kind, and were not adopted in accordance with the law. Such requirements increase costs of monitoring and reporting for growers in the Central Coast, and this can affect the agricultural community and the economy in the region. Each successive monitoring and reporting requirement, like those in this revised MRP, adds a significant cost to agricultural production. Growers in the Central Coast have limited ability, if any, to pass on higher costs associated with production, including regulatory costs. In adopting the orders, the board was required to provide written explanation and evidence regarding the need for the requested sampling and reporting. Nothing in the revised MRP orders or the notice provided with it met this standard. The board also did not consider whether the burden of complying with the revised MRP is reasonable when weighed against the need for reporting. The revised orders were made by the executive officer at the direction of the Central Coast Water Board, as we've been told. However, this direction lacked specificity and does not make up for the lack of opportunity for public notice and comment prior to adoption. I did attend the July board meeting, and as I reviewed the notice and associated staff report, I do not believe that it alerted the public that substantial MRP changes were being considered before the adoption of a new order. Had it, I would have been prepared to speak to them, and I would have had more members there prepared to speak to them. An important point to note, I believe, is that, which I also believe contradicts the staff report, while we participated in the referenced August 15 meeting, the context of the meeting in general was on Ag Order 3.0. So we, and I'm including my partners in agriculture, we really understood the reference to the addition of the neonics and increased pyrethroid testing to be part of that broader discussion of 3.0. One of my colleagues also, specifically Norm Groot, he noted concern with the new testing being proposed specifically in that meeting. But again, when we all came away, we thought, okay, this is something we're going to take to our members and start talking about because it's going to be coming up in this whole process for the 2017 renewal. And I say that because it's important to look at this in light of the previous process, which was the 2010 through the 2012 revisions. And when we're making substantial changes to the orders, those orders were adopted after numerous drafts that were considered after extensive public comment was heard and then extensive discussion was given at the board. Petitioners collectively and individually also developed and submitted various versions of draft alternatives that were considered by the board, and a series of revisions took place over the course of a couple of years. So we're concerned that due process wasn't met in this case. When an administrative agency takes a quasi-judicial action, it must satisfy due process requirements. And I'm going to reference Beck Development Company versus Southern Pacific Transportation. They said, when a quasi-judicial action is to be taken, procedures must be available to provide, at a minimum, notice and an opportunity for a hearing. As a general permit, the conditional waiver order and its associated monitoring and reporting programs, they are quasi-judicial in nature. And this is because the order and revised MRP are the means by which certain water quality standards are applied to a specific set of farmers and ranchers. We don't believe that the Central Coast Board offered an opportunity for affected parties, including petitioners and their members, to be heard in regard to the revised MRP orders. Instead, we believe that the board's officer provided notice that the 2012 MRP orders had been revised on August 22nd, the same day the notice was issued. We don't believe that this meets the minimum requirements for due process, and we believe that the board failed to engage the regulated community in a manner that would have identified the evidentiary issues complained of within. We believe the board's action has not afforded petitioners their due process protections, and accordingly, the revised MRP orders are invalid and should be set aside until they can be modified in compliance with due process, especially with an opportunity for petitioners to provide comments on the revised MRPs. Additionally, with the addition of the neonicotinoids and additional pyrethroid sampling, we're concerned that the revisions included are not supported by findings that clearly demonstrate the burden of compliance is reasonable in light of the benefit to be conferred, and that would be in violation of the Water Code. There are no findings that support the need for monitoring certain insecticides or for increased monitoring frequencies for these insecticides that are mentioned in the amended MRP. In light of recent publications such as the Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry article entitled Ecological Risk Assessment for Aquatic Invertebrate Communities Exposed to Imidacloprid Due to Labeled Agricultural and Non-Agricultural Uses in the United States, we learn, and as you're aware, imidacloprid is a neonicotinoid. That article indicated that aquatic invertebrate community is unlikely to be adversely affected by acute or chronic exposure to imidacloprid resulting from currently registered uses of imidacloprid in the United States. That's one of the reasons we question the basis for the findings. Additionally, the only evidence cited to support the revised MRP orders is the conditional waiver adopted in 2012. However, nothing in the conditional waiver mentions neonicotinoids, nor is the required increase in pyrethroid monitoring explained or justified. The notice stated that the revised MRP orders must be implemented beginning in 2017, and it included sampling frequencies for pyrethroid pesticides and toxicity testing for a new species, and added monitoring for neonicotinoid pesticides. There was no consideration or comparison of the reasonableness of the burden of these changes against the need for additional information. The MRP made no mention of the authority to set these revised monitoring requirements, and these changes increase the sampling and analytical testing required to comply with the revised MRP orders at an expected rate of 69% over what the growers are paying in 2016. The only evidence supporting the revised MRP order is the conditional waiver issued in 2012. And while that waiver mentions pyrethroid and neonicotinoid pesticides, the evidence included there does not support the increased monitoring for pyrethroids nor the addition of monitoring for neonics. And we believe the lack of evidence supporting the revised MRP orders is grounds for invalidation. Additionally, the revised MRPs merely reference the conditional waiver as the source establishing the need for these provisions and the source of evidence supporting the increased burdens on growers, but they do not analyze the relationship between the burdens and the necessity of the information to be obtained. I realize that I only have a little bit of time left, so I was going to speak a little bit more to burdens, but instead I'm just going to repeat our request of you. We ask the board to direct the executive officer to recall or overwrite the August 22nd MRPs and revert to the previous MRP requirements. And we ask that any changes to the MRPs be addressed publicly through the public process for amending the current ag order, which will include public comments, outreach meetings, and a public board meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Abby. And I will, you know, continue with the speakers, and because I have quite a few speaker cards, and at the end, unless there's, you know, a key clarification that someone requests, you know, at the end of the speaker presentations, then we can add more comments and questions from fellow board members, unless there's a specific item that you have a question for. So the next speaker request is Mr. Randy Scher. That's 3 minutes, please.
Good morning, Randy Scher. I'm on both the Groundwater Conservation or the CCGC and Preservation Inc. Plus, I'm here also speaking for Claire. It took two of us to do her job. To clarify, carbamates and the organochlorides are both restricted materials. The arduousness that growers have to go through to apply them is why their uses are going down. It's not groundwater testing or anything of that nature. It's just because of the restrictive natures of those materials, they'll continue to go down. A couple of things on the expanded monitoring reporting. Angela spoke of it. There is some question on what the language is as far as domestic water. Current language is all wells that are used or may be used for groundwater drinking. The language changes to groundwater wells that are located within the property boundary in the enrolled county APN. That's different language, and it could be a huge expansion of the number of wells tested. Also, clarity on the ag wells to make sure it calls out just the primary ag wells on the properties, because again, it could be an expansion in sampling if it's all wells on every property. Number of properties have a primary ag well can irrigate multiple properties. Other points are keeping the 2012 nitrate loading, risk calculation, risk unit language for the Tier 2 and Tier 3 ranches intact. The TNA reporting should be a 1-1 to 12-31 reporting time frame with an April 1st due date. The TNA should be based on nitrate applied per acre per year, regardless of whether the crop's been harvested or where it is in the growing cycle. I honestly believe this will get a far better, in the long term, use report on how much nitrate is being applied per acre on each one of these APNs, whether, you know, growers like it or not, and I'm not in favor of it, but I think the reality is with the expansion of all nitrates being reported regardless of their risk rate, and the advancement, more nitrate reporting is going to be required. It will be much easier, clearer, and I think better data if it is a 1-1 to 12-31 time frame rather than regardless of the timing of the harvest. We believe that we should place key requirements in the order rather than the MRPs, and that would eliminate any vagaries or any type of uncertainties. Maintain the calendar date of March 1 for the ENOI updates. Retain a 60-day time frame for the enrollment and termination requirement. That's important because of rotational grounds with minimizing inputs. Guys will continue and probably do more in the future rotating ground, so having that 60-day window is important. Implement standards of of the reporting to have the deadlines by April 1st. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. And next speaker is Mr. Perry Clausen. And for clarification, you requested 5 minutes, but originally your request was for 10 minutes. So what is it going to be, 5 or 10?
Depends on if I go long or not.
So
probably 5 minutes. It'd probably be the shorter of the two.
All right.
And thank you, Chair Wolf, for the time. My name is Perry Clausen, Executive Director of the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition. And just to put out that we have it currently 539 grower members in the Central Coast region with approximately 206,000 irrigated acres. So just a clarification of what I'm going to be talking about. The Central Coast Groundwater Coalition, since the MRP 17 was announced, had a little bit of consternation because the language of the MRP didn't include a cooperative groundwater monitoring component. We were assured by staff that we could put a proposal forward, and so began to proceed with putting that proposal together. We now see the change and the addition made in the 3.0 MRP that includes the coalition. So the comments I'm going to make are about MRP 17, but they apply to what the next agenda item is, but I think that should be all right. Right? Okay. So what we are planning to do is prepare a proposal, and we have it in a draft form now. We submitted it to staff earlier this week. They didn't have a chance to review it before our meeting, so really didn't get many substantial comments back from them yet. They committed to getting together with us in the next week or two to go over the details of the plan. Just the overview of what we are intending to do is that it would cover the time period from March 2017 until 4.0 is updated. And what we want to continue to do is provide the high-quality data that we have for the last 3 years. Since we started the coalition, we intend and commit to doing that. And we think the sampling methodology that we would use throughout our program would, again, match to what we've done in the past and enable us to have put the basis for possibly a trend monitoring network in 4.0. We also have found in the 3 years that we've operated a lot of feedback from our members about our ability to help them fill out their paperwork. There's lots of reporting requirements. We intend to ramp that up to assist the other groups, Abby's groups, the GSAs and farm bureaus. They do that a lot for their members. We plan to expand that in 3.0 as part of our plan. And then also should be able to help out if the TNA, total nitrogen apply reporting, increases to the other growers, that we should be able to assist on that. And really the idea is we want to have for our plan as a scientifically based groundwater monitoring program. So I want to just also reiterate some of the comments and all the comments that Abby made. The MRP 17 was a little on the rush side. It was we did have the conference calls. It was explained, but we were right in the middle of harvest season. We didn't give it the due process attention that we normally would for something so substantial. So really do support what Abby has said. In fact, CCGC was a co-signator to the petition to the state board, put it in abeyance in hopes that we can get it worked out, of course. And then also the expanding of the domestic well definition is a little problematic in that we started out with a domestic well sampling program and it started expanding to other wells. And we think the language should remain the same and the definition the same. And then the other thing is that you will always have this in the Central Coast because of the way the landowner-operator system is set up. We have a lot of operators who get the property to farm the property. They have nothing to do with the house, but the APN is not split up, for the House is not split off from their membership parcel. That continues to create kind of friction with our with growers and those landowners, and it makes it difficult to put the onus on our members and the growers to somewhat enforce your program to people that they are, and they really are beholden to. They are the landowners and the lessees. So we've not quite figured out, I don't think we have in this next order, how to differentiate that and how to put that responsibility for that landowner not on the coalition membership, because it just puts them in a very awkward position. So that's a summary of my comments, and appreciate the time, and I'll take any questions later if need be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next request is Mr. Kirk Schmidt, and in 10 minutes we're pre-agreed.
Thank you very much, Chair Wolf. My 10-minute request was for item 12. Not for this item. I'll be much briefer on this item.
Say that again, please.
My request for 10 minutes was on item 12, which is the next item on the agenda. This is item 11, dealing only with the 2017 MRP.
Okay, because you had, you had requested 3 minutes.
For this, yes.
Okay, so we'll make it 3 minutes for this item, and then we'll make it 10 minutes for the next item.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Addressing the formative process of the 2017 MRP, I've appeared before your board repeatedly at the beginning of this year, and up through July, there was a concern about the process of establishing an MRP for 2017. During your July hearing in Santa Barbara, there was consensus that the executive officer had the ability to review the MRP and make changes for 2017. During the first weeks of August, Preservation Inc. had numerous conference calls with your staff dealing with the MRP. And in the past, we have dealt with the executive officer when there needed to be changes in the MRP, some of which were very minor. I fully understand the concerns of the agricultural community that there was lack of disclosure or discussion of the changes. And Preservation Inc. was also somewhat shocked by the extent of the changes, because initially we were led to believe in July that the 2017 MRP would be very similar to 2016. The 2017 MRP is a tremendous change from 2016, and it results in a monitoring program that is the most expensive monitoring program that Preservation Inc. has done in 12 years on the Central Coast. The cost to the growers from 2016 to 2017 will increase by 69% across the board. So there was a significant increase in detail and breadth and the nature of the monitoring going forward in 2017. However, while it makes sense because of the tremendous changes that the agricultural community be brought in to discuss these before the order was adopted by the executive officer, there is a reason why Preservation Inc. appreciates the ability to discuss changes with the executive officer in lieu of coming before your board. In the past, we've had problems dealing with the bioassessment, and we work with your executive officer and staff to change how the bioassessment was implemented, because we didn't have a legal right to go 500 feet upstream to do the monitoring without trespassing on growers. And we were able to work out an accommodation where if we received consent, we could do this. And that still left us in compliance with the MRP, even though we were only then able to do a little over 30% of the sites instead of 100% of the sites. So the ability to deal with your executive officer, which has been in both the original Ag Order and the 2012 Ag Order, is appreciated by us. But because of the breadth of the changes in this specific MRP, it did make sense that the executive officer or staff should have at least brought the content of the MRP and made it available before it was adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And next 3 minutes is for Ms. Sara Lopez.
Good morning. My name is Sara Lopez. I'm the technical program manager for the Cooperative Monitoring Program for surface water. I had two comments. One is just an informational or clarification. In past pesticide and toxicity discussions, we've talked about chemical pesticide analyses, and then we also have the laboratory toxicity tests, which expose sensitive organisms to the sample water in a laboratory and look for effects. What's being discussed now, especially with regard to neonicotinoids and pyrethroids, are sometimes much lower concern levels that would not measurably affect the test organisms in those laboratory toxicity tests. Or sometimes I also see data presentations simply discussing detection versus non-detection of a pesticide, regardless of whether or not those detections exceed a concern threshold. And I don't mean to challenge the point that your staff have made that the lethal effects thresholds are not necessarily protective enough. I mean, that idea makes sense. But our data discussions need to clarify whether we're talking about mere detection, non-detection, versus no effect thresholds or very low effect thresholds versus lethal or reproductive effects to toxicity test organisms, because that's really the only instance in which the chemical pesticide data line up with the toxicity monitoring data. So I see this as especially important in our discussions of neonicotinoids and pyrethroids. The second point I wanted to make is that pesticides and toxicity are a really important piece of the discussion on agricultural impacts to water quality, and they are also hands down the most expensive piece of the monitoring discussion. So it's really important for us to address pesticides in a robust and holistic way, and it's also important to plan carefully the monitoring program to have our dollars spent on good, useful information. In the past, we've had a robust technical scoping process to develop MRPs with input from multiple stakeholders and a big picture vision for at least a 5-year timeline. I would encourage a return to that model, and I'm a little bit disappointed that we're discussing a single year of monitoring today in isolation from long-term monitoring objectives. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. And next 3 minutes is for Ms. Kay Mercer.
Hello, I'm Kay Mercer, and I'm president of KMI, and I thank you for allowing me to come before you. I would like to comment today on the proposed annual reporting frequency of the Tier 3 INMP, effectiveness report, and the water quality buffer plan. Also, I'd like to comment on the nexus between the Tier 3 compliance burden and the water quality protection or improvements. I've been working with two growers that have Tier 3 farm ranches, and I recently contracted with a third. I did an analysis of the consulting cost associated with the INMP plan and effectiveness reporting. And this analysis does not include the management practices implementation. So for one client, the total consulting cost since mid-2014 is about $63,825. That's just for doing the INMP and the effectiveness report. That's about $2,200 a month and about $26,000 a year. We think this is likely an underestimate, as initially I did not track the Tier 3 compliance requirements separately. I just lumped them into ag waiver compliance. My second client has not incurred this level of expense to date because they initially relied on a vendor. When it came time to write the effectiveness report, the vendor was unable to deliver. Hence, we expect their cost to increase a lot. Why are the expenses so great? In the State Water Board's petition order, they did not anticipate the uncertainty that would surround how much information is divulged to the public. Consequently, my clients have to hire the best consultants they can find and the best attorneys they can find to review all the reports, because they don't know what will be given to the public and what the public will do with that. The lack of technical service providers also is concerning. When we first started looking for people to write the plans and the reports, I found identified six people that were interested. Out of those six, only one remains. He has a PhD in agronomy. The point to this cost analysis is that there may not be a reasonable burden on the growers and may not be a reasonable nexus between the costs associated with Tier 3 compliance requirements and actual water quality protection. The nexus becomes even more tenuous when one drills down to the specific reports, such as the INMP effectiveness report. From a perspective of the iterative process, the proposed annual frequency of reporting is just too frequent. And the reason I say that is that it takes time to submit the report, to get feedback can be months before we get feedback from the regional board. Then to incorporate that back into your INMP for your next report, it's not going to happen in a 12-month period. In addition to this request, one of my clients has, with a Tier 3 ranch, has requested that I talk about the allocation of his environmental budget. Because the Tier 3 ranches have greater visibility and are more politically vulnerable, he's focused on those Tier 3 ranches, whereas he sees other ranches that probably need more attention, but he has to funnel that all of his resources to those Tier 3 ranches. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Next, 3 minutes is for Ms. Heather Lucas.
Ready? Yeah. Hi, my name is Heather Lucas, and I work for the Environmental Justice Coalition for Water in our Salinas office. I am EJCW's Central Coast Technical Assistance Specialist. As I think many of you know, we work with small, disadvantaged communities in throughout the Pajaro and the Salinas Valleys, on all of which have high levels of nitrate contamination in domestic drinking water wells. We work with these communities to help identify and implement interim and long-term safe water solutions. So monitoring and reporting specifically about domestic wells is really important to us, as well as the notification and the accurate communication of health risks posed by nitrate to all local residents. EJCW is going to be submitting written comments by the January 3rd deadline. Sorry. today, I just want to make a couple general comments. First, the monitoring of domestic wells. It's really important. For if the goal of this monitoring is to protect public health, it's really important for us that we require monitoring of all the domestic wells on the same parcel as the discharger. We also think that that's not really enough. From our perspective, there are contaminants that can be introduced at the ground surface on one parcel that can easily reach domestic water wells on nearby parcels. In many cases, we believe that dischargers should also be required to monitor these domestic wells. So we're just affirming what is written in the current proposed monitoring plan and saying that in the future we'd like to see that extended. Another thing is I just want to remind of the urgency of not only the monitoring but also taking action. We believe that this monitoring is also a really important part of implementing the human right to water in California. Our work, as I mentioned, is really... we rely on existing data provided by the Monterey County Department of Environmental Health. And this is really, there are significant data gaps, such as that private domestic wells are largely left out of the data that we have. And as I'm sure you also see in existing data, we see levels of nitrate across the Pajaro and Salinas Valleys increasing dramatically in groundwater. And we find this to be alarming. And another thing is that many people are unaware of this nitrate in their domestic wells, and we believe that we need to take action now in order to protect public health. The last thing that I want to mention is that, unfortunately, well, let's see, if we really want to implement the human right to water in California, I think we need to first identify the source of pollution, and we also need to appropriately require the polluters to pay for the cleanup at the source. I think that, unfortunately, in our work, what we are seeing now is that the burden of the contaminated drinking water continues to fall on those with the most limited amount of financial resources to pay for alternative safe water sources. We will also make some comments in the public comment period later. So thank you.
Thank you. Next 3 minutes is for Nafenrel Kane.
Good morning, Chairman Wolf and members of the board. My name is Nathaniel Kane. I am with the Environmental Law Foundation. And I'm going to try to keep this brief. First of all, I want to say that we are glad that the board is doing monitoring in 2017. I know there was some question as to whether that was going to happen at all. And I know that some objections have been raised and petitions have been sent. And I hope that the board will actually follow through and require monitoring next year. I think it's very important. Secondly, I want to emphasize that the data produced as a result of groundwater monitoring is public data under Section 13269 of the Water Code. This monitoring is public, and I certainly hope that the board continues to make that data available to the public. Thirdly, I know that there has now been a cooperative monitoring proposal submitted to the board. I haven't had a chance to see it yet, but I would again encourage the board to make sure that data, including data about notifications to well users, is made available to the public under this program. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. In the next 3 minutes is Brian Anderson.
Thank you, Chairman Wolf. Brian Anderson, UC Davis. I'm an aquatic toxicologist with the Granite Canyon Lab. And I'm here basically to give my support to the revised Ag Order 3.0, the monitoring component. I think we all agree that the monitoring programs, I think all the stakeholders agree that these monitoring programs should be based on good science, and I actually feel that this revision to the program is based on good science. We want to be protective of the environment, and we want to have the programs evolve as new information becomes available, and that's exactly what staff have done. So in this context, we know that there's changing pesticide use patterns, and so we want to have appropriate indicators that evolve with this change so that we're protective of the environment. So the three species that they've now included in monitoring, the three invertebrates, are appropriate because they have sensitivities that address the different types of pesticides that are being used. And for example, the addition of the insect larva Coronomus to address neonicotinoids is completely appropriate because neonicotinoid use is increasing worldwide and also in California. So one example is Orcutt Creek. We've been doing collaborative monitoring recently with DPR, who monitors this region. They just do pesticide monitoring. We've added a toxicity component. And Orcutt Creek is now under a TMDL for pre-thread pesticides, right? You guys agreed to that, I think, last year. That creek, now we're seeing in monitoring with Seria daphnia, Hyalella, and Coronomus, is toxic almost exclusively to Coronomus, and it's because of the presence of imidacloprid in that creek. So we think this is actually in response to the TMDL. The growers have switched the types of pesticides that they're using, and they're using this newer class, and so we're seeing it at toxic concentrations. That's an example. If we just had the traditional three species testing, we would be missing that picture. We would be under protecting the environment. And I think Mr. Young talked about this idea of this pesticide treadmill. How are we going to get ahead of this? And one thing that we're trying to promote is timely data with the appropriate indicators so that we can work with the larger regulatory agencies. In this case, it's the State Water Board and DPR. They're communicating on a national level with EPA to try to get ahead of this pesticide treadmill so that we can be more proactive and prevent these problems from happening before we're at the point of measuring them in our environment. So, thank you.
Thank you for your comment. And Mr. Steve Shimmick, 3 minutes.
Good morning. It's still morning. Steve Shimmick with Otter Project in Monterey Coast Keeper. I was disappointed in some of the comments that were made, the public comments that were made by the agricultural folks, just because I think that they are essentially arguing against adapting to the current and real world. I think that they're arguing against nimbleness, which was one of the words that was used this morning. I think that they're arguing against adaptive management, which is what we were promised when the ag order was implemented. And I think that these are important concepts. So we're in support of the staff recommendation, and I could end it right there, but I don't have faith that you're going to go with the staff recommendation. So if you were to change, here's some of the changes we would like to see. Although, again, let's be clear, we're in support of what the staff wants to do. So we would suggest that if you do change, imidacloprid should be added to the list of contaminants tested for in groundwater as well. And that's because there's this one report that was not mentioned earlier, and it's called Environmental Fate of Imidacloprid, and it was came out on September 1st, 2016, and from DPR, and it's quite amazing, and it's quite thorough. One of the quotes is, concentrations of imidacloprid, especially in agricultural areas of California, are reported in the SURF database at levels capable of causing short and long-term impacts on aquatic invertebrate species. So we think that, and because it is long-lived in the environment, up to 1,000 days, 3 years, and because it is incredibly water-soluble, it is considered also a threat to groundwater. I'll be talking more about that and in a different comment period. We do agree with, we do not agree with just wholesale eliminating flathead minnow, unless it's replaced by rainbow trout, which are also an EPA authorized test species that is incredibly appropriate for the Central Coast as it applies to steelhead. We disagree with the elimination of, I have a hard time with some of these names, carbamids. The reality is that we're playing whack-a-mole, and we don't know when we knock down some of these other pesticides where it's going to come up again. And I would draw your attention to the vocabulary used on page 4 of the staff report, where it says, as far as the eliminated carbamates pesticides, it says very limited exceedances. It's not talking about detections. It's talking about that there are exceedances happening. Finally, let's just recognize that monitoring is not the end goal here. Monitoring, you know, we have plenty of monitoring. We know what the problems are, and this is your next agenda item, and that's what are you going to do about the monitoring? Monitoring is not the goal. Monitoring is not the goal. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And let's see, questions, and of course we'll give opportunity for staff to also, you know, clarify or respond to some of the public questions.
Is that the last speaker?
Yes. So, Mr. Young?
Well, how do you want to do it? I mean,
well,
I'm sure we all have a lot of questions.
I would suggest that we ask questions And that will also help staff then formulating response, which would clarify questions that we may have, and also perhaps give the opportunity for staff to respond to some of the speakers. Mr. Robertson, are you comfortable with that approach?
Yes, yeah, and I would like us to have an opportunity at the end, like you suggested, to respond to some of the key points we heard.
Sure. So I will start on my extreme left. Mayor Delgado.
All right. Thank you to all the speakers. I'm often impressed by staff reports, and I'm really impressed by the speakers, too. I think we can all admit that this is a good quality, a good caliber of opinions being expressed today and facts. Abby brought up the issue of due process, and I think other speakers did as well. So my question is, what authority does the executive director have, or does us, the board, have to amend the MRPs sort of with or without public comment? Because the July board meeting, apparently public comment ended before a lot of board discussion occurred that then translated to some of the changes in the MRPs, although I know there's some concern that it was even independent of the board contact communication. But can we get an opinion on what authority our executive director has or the board has to amend our MRPs?
Either the board or the executive officer can amend the MRPs basically at any time. The amount of process you need to provide depends on the extent of the changes that you're making. Staff said that the changes were intended to be cost neutral, which means that you don't have to have much of a process. The regulated community is taking the position that the changes are much more extensive. But there was a process. There was an opportunity to confer with staff. There's conflicting testimony about the extent of information that was given and the understanding on the part of the regulated community in terms of what changes were anticipated. But that's all moot because we're having a process now. The public had the opportunity to come before you. We've been hearing this item for over an hour and a half. So I'm not sure what additional process anybody is requesting beyond the process that you've had today. Does that answer your question, or did you have other specific questions about the ability to change the order?
It was a good starter. I had a second question in this regard, and I think I heard today that part of the concern of lack of due process, as perceived by some of our speakers, was not only not knowing what was coming, but that what has come down the pike in the last couple of months, I'm hearing it said that claimed that there's not sufficient information given to justify these changes, and that's part that they want due access to the reasoning and the substantiation of the need. So can you speak to that?
Yeah, and I think at this point that's really form over substance. There was an extensive staff report that provided the justification for the changes. There's been testimony today explaining why the changes are being made, why we are able to eliminate some of the constituents, and why the increase is necessary. We could always, the executive officer could always adopt the staff report or make findings based upon the staff report as the findings in support of the order. But substantively, staff has provided the explanation for why these changes were made.
Okay. I kind of feel sorry for those that only have 3 minutes because it's hard for them to get in what they say, and it's hard for us to understand what they're saying because they have to talk a little faster. When Randy spoke, I was left wondering which of his concerns staff believes are being accommodated or taken care of, and which are outstanding and not being accommodated, and why, if not?
So I can speak to some of those, and I think some of Randy's comments, Mr. Scherer's comments, were addressing actually item 12 or proposed changes to included in draft 3.0. And many of those comments actually reflect proposed changes in 3.0, such as recommended date changes and the proposed monitoring year with respect to nitrogen applied. So I think a fair amount of those comments that Mr. Scherer made are already reflected in the draft order. Now, I don't want to mischaracterize. He also made some comments about the monitoring and reporting program, and I think that those changes are not, or those requests for change are not reflected in the amended MRP, and that's the point of this item.
I couldn't track which ones he mentioned that are not. Can you tell us why the ones he mentioned that are not being reflected, why they're not being reflected?
Without a perfect list and a perfect memory, and the second one is critical, I can't go back and recount unless I sat down probably with Mr. Scherer's list and then walked right through them. Are you comfortable with that, Chris?
I think I can address Mr. Scherer's comments when staff has an opportunity to respond later.
All right. But the TNA January 1 to 12/31, that's a 3.0 question that's going to be addressed later today. All right. Does staff agree with Randy's statement that carbonates and organochlorines usage are decreasing due not to the groundwater sampling burden, but to restrictive pesticide labels they have?
Well, that certainly may be possible. I don't know that, frankly, Mr. Scherer is a grower, and he would know better than I what sort of regulatory hoops he has to jump through in order to use those chemicals. I'll leave it at that. I don't question Mr. Scherer's statement about that.
Okay. Because I think that's important for us to know that it's not part of the pesticide treadmill. It's that they'd rather not use those because of the labeling requirements. So,
may I say that, I mean, if we do want to talk about this now, carbamates are being used. They are being used. We just haven't seen exceedances of the thresholds that we have for carbamates, particularly when you take a look at it in comparison to some of the other things that are being used increasingly, like the neonicotinoids and the pyrethroids. So if we want to prioritize our efforts, our monitoring efforts, we think that carbamates will be lower on the list compared to pyrethroids and neonics. That's not to say that carbamates aren't being used, because they are.
Okay, thank you. Harry summarized one of the objections in the December 2nd, 2016 Grower Shipper Association of Santa Barbara San Luis County's letter, talking about how the domestic well definition has expanded. And I wonder if staff could discuss if it's been expanded technically or in practical terms or not.
As Ms. Schroeder said earlier, the definition that is now in the amended MRPs is consistent with what we have been implementing with respect to groundwater monitoring. So, I don't think it is not a departure from what we have already been implementing, rather a clarification to the public of how we're going to proceed with groundwater monitoring requirements.
So technically it reads differently, the new definition, but in practical terms it's being implemented. It will be implemented the same as it has been in the last few years?
Yes.
Okay. As far as the per farm or ranch well compared to the APN well, if I'm a grower and I'm using water from a well that's off of my farm or outside of my growing area, but within the APN, if you use the per farm or ranch definition, would I be required to sample that well that's supplying my crop from off-farm location?
Angela Schroeder, section manager. So the answer to your question, Mr. Delgado, is no. So if we use the ranch definition, the grower would not be required to sample that domestic well that was off the ranch boundary. But making it the APN boundary, it includes that well.
Is that important in that, does that occur in real life? Is that something that we as a board should be aware of?
Yeah, it's very important. And in fact, and that's why we had a lot of due diligence with growers at the beginning of the implementation of the groundwater monitoring requirements to clarify that, because the ranch boundaries typically cut out those domestic wells that are maybe at the residence on the ranch or a workshop on the ranch. And so it's kind of like this donut hole. So if we want to capture the domestic well use associated with the agricultural properties enrolled in the order, we have to do that through the APN. And in cases where growers don't have access to that well, we seek assistance from the landowner.
Okay. Do you, Angela, think that the definition is expanding what a domestic well is?
No. From an implementation perspective, with a 2012 order, it's identical.
Well, that's a practical...
That's correct. It's clarification.
But so do you think in an official or technical way there's an expanding definition?
I don't believe so, no.
Can I just ask her a question about this? I want to know what the practical result of this is going to be. Are there going to be more domestic wells sampled? That's what this is about.
That's correct. So I do not believe it adds wells to be sampled. The wells that we're describing now were required to be sampled as part of the 2012 order. And it clarifies, and we had the clarification and guidance, and in fact, growers said it would be more clear if we included that clarification within the order itself rather than in associated documents outside, which were separate from the order.
So you don't see this as requiring more wells to be sampled?
That's correct.
So, Mr. Young, this is consistent with the dialogue that we've had pre-Groundwater Coalition work plan. I think you may have actually even attended one of those meetings with Mr. Jeffries where we had that discussion. We were actually talking about trying to articulate this as clearly as possible, and we were drawing it on a easel chart to try to get at, you know, addressing wells on APNs that were farmed.
Well, you're younger than me, so your memory's better.
Touch and go.
I vaguely remember that, but okay.
Vaguely, that's not a legal term.
Oh, yes, it is.
Only as a but there's an engineer, I'll call it a cop-out. Sorry. I had to put a little levity, you know, in the discussion. So, Mr. Delgado, do you have additional questions?
Yeah, moving
questions?
On to Kirk's. Thank you, Chair.
Sure.
Kirk Schmidt's comments. If indeed it's true that the changes in the MRPs as of August would result in a 69% increase in cost to growers, does that affect our reasonableness in this revised MRP proposal?
So I'm going to ask Chris Rose to provide some clarity about that 69% reference that we had. I think the statement made was the relative cost between the amended 2017 MRP and the 2016 monitoring year cost was 69%. Can you reflect, Chris, on preceding years, 2015, 2014, as an example of relative cost?
Yes. So what Mr. Schmidt said is something to the effect of the cost increase between 2016 and the proposed or the amended 2017 MRPs will be a 69% increase in cost. And between those 2 years, I'm sure that is true. However, 2016 was not the most expensive year. for the cooperative monitoring program, because that's not the year when they were doing the monitoring of the pesticides and some of the other pesticides, like pyrethroids, for example. So their most expensive year was a few years before that. And Mr. Schmidt and I had a conversation a while back about what would be the comparison of the proposed monitoring compared to one of those more expensive years, like from 2013 or 14, I believe is what it was. And if memory serves, that cost increase would be under 10%. So relative to the most expensive year, it would be like, I think you said, an 8% increase.
Okay. Thank you. And I know we're not to get into the 3.0, so I just want to ask very briefly, Do these 2017 MRPs closely match what's going to be in what's proposed in 3.0 for 2018 and 19?
Not for 19, but for 18, yes.
Okay, so 17, 18 may be similar to.
Yes, the amended MRPs and with the proposed as in the draft order, yes, the 2018 and 2019 cost would be similar. Correct. But then 2019 would be a reduced cost year so that they could spread that cost out to 3 years, one being a less expensive year.
So to clarify, 2017 and 2018 will be very similar, are proposed to be very similar with respect to requirements, monitoring requirements. 2019, the proposed monitoring is ramping down, right?
My last question regards something that Steve said. He brought up the concern about aminoclopurized, and he quoted a DPR report, I think, from this year. What is staff's take on that issue?
Yeah, Mr. Delgado, are you referring to Mr. Schimmick's concern about aminoclopurid in groundwater?
Correct.
Yes, okay. So, yes, aminoclopurid is highly soluble. To my knowledge, I don't know of any data from Department of Pesticide Regulation or anybody else showing that it is in groundwater. However, I think what Mr. Schimmick was saying is that because of its solubility, is there a danger of it going to groundwater? I cannot answer that today, but again, to my knowledge, we have not seen it show up in groundwater.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Johnson? Thank you, Chair Wolf. Is it appropriate for me to ask questions of the speakers?
Sure.
Okay, I have a question first for Abby Taylor-Silva, who was speaking on behalf of all farmers everywhere, or at least a couple of grower shippers and a farm bureau. So my question is, listening to you and reading the comment letter which we received from the Grower Shipper Association of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties, it appears that the request is that the board either act or direct the executive officer to rescind this MRP and to revert to the 2014 MRP. Is that correct?
Right, the previous MRP.
Now, pardon?
I think what Ms. Silva said is, please refer back to the 2016. I think you said 14, but you meant 16.
Well, the previous MRP as it relates to surface water, I think, is ours. So I think Claire mentioned 2014, but, yeah, I mean, the 2016 is actually where I think where Preservation Inc. has been to this state. Our expectation was that it was going to simply be carried over. So, yes, revert back to the most previous
okay.
MRP.
I'm a little confused because it seems like there's an argument being made that for due process reasons, there should have been a hearing, presentation of evidence, et cetera, before an MRP was issued for 2017, and if we revert to the previous MRP, if my recollection is correct, it had no monitoring requirements for 2017. So it seems a little circular
to say, by due process, we should set this aside and revert to the earlier one, which has no monitoring requirements.
And so,
I'm just trying to understand what you're asking and understand how it works logically.
So the expectation was, based on feedback that we'd heard through our colleagues at Preservation, Inc., was that really the idea was looking to have the 2017 order be an extension of that previous order so that you could continue the surface monitoring program. We were never asking for the surface water monitoring program to cease. It was just continue the current order monitoring program into 2017 because you have this timeline with the new order where
so
you have this
it,
public process.
Is it your position then that if the MRP that was issued in August had fewer changes in it, that there would not have been a due process issue?
Yes.
Thank you. Now, my next question is for Perry, and we've heard Angela from staff repeatedly state that the change in the language regarding the definition of domestic wells will not result in a change in the number of domestic wells that have to be monitored because it is simply consolidating into the MRP the concept that was in the guidance already. But you spoke against the change in domestic well definition. Is it your position that this is going to result in more wells being monitored?
Yes, because the definition that we started the program in was that a domestic well served rural residences. It was a house on a farm, so people that were in those homes, we tested their wells to see if it was above the nitrates, notified them replacement water was granted. So what started to happen in the program was the shop wells. There's a tractor wash station. There's lots of uses of water besides the residents on there. So what happened is then we were instructed by staff to sample those as well. So there was no, it was an addition of two wells in the program. So if this is, and not all members, we didn't send out announcements, okay, if you have shop wells. If they informed us that they had a well that had some uses like an office or whatnot, then and they asked us, we added it on in the previous program. So now with a new MRP, the growers who have a shop well and want to have those sampled will have additional wells sampled. Now the definition of, is that a domestic rural residential well? In my book, no, it's a shop well. It's a wash station well. So it's kind of, we're splitting hairs on definitions, but it could potentially have a lot more wells that had not been sampled because they weren't a rural residential domestic well.
So
makes sense.
Is it your understanding, though, that the guidance, that the concept has been there in the guidance for the last 4 years?
No, it was just rural domestic wells. We talked to staff, and they said that's when we started asking staff about that correction, right? That's the conversations we had. There was no written definition of a shop well being a rural domestic well.
So the guidance was,
at least to my recollection, I've got our technicians in the back.
The concept that staff is telling us was in the guidance back in 2012 was oral, not written?
Yes, because Angela, you can clarify, but we were not under the assumption to check for shop wells.
I want to see how high they place the mic when the two of them are sharing
right it. Right in the middle there. So the guidance that was written in a companion document for growers specified that it was any well that could be used for human consumption, cooking, or sanitary purposes. But they included domestic well residence or workshop or place of business, but that may be used for human consumption, cooking, or sanitary purposes. It wasn't a tractor wash station. So, I mean, clearly we still have to clarify, but even between ourselves. But again, the definition that we provided in the guidance to growers was a residence workshop or place of business that may be used for human consumption, cooking, or sanitary purposes. It's consistent with what the environmental health agencies use, as well as the human rights water law.
Okay, and that was written guidance.
It was written guidance, right? Okay. Just to clarify what a domestic well was.
Okay, thank you. So, all right, I think that answers my question. Let me just see if I have any more. That's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Young?
I have some questions. I'd like to start with staff. And can you please go over again what the evidence is to support the changes? And, you know, you put up one graph. I think it was dealing with one particular neonic. And do you have more data than that? You put up the usage
yes.
changes, the poundage, the increase in usage between chemicals between 2010 and 2014.
Yes.
But I would like to see all the evidence you have to support the changes.
Okay. Well, actually, before I leave this slide, one of the board members had a question about how can we have 78% and 67% for Hylal and Chironomus respectively and then have a combined of 89% is just a mathematical phenomenon. So the Hylal toxicity level is 78%, the Chironomus toxicity level is 67% for those samples in each one of these species. But when you add those species together and get a sum for how many, when you add the number of samples together and then take a look at the proportion that were that showed toxicity, the combined is 89%. It's just a mathematical phenomenon. So, yes, Mr. Young, so let's go back here for a moment. I'm sorry? That didn't help? Would you like me to go over it again, or you're okay? Okay, we can go over it again. And so if you take a look at the number of samples here under Hylala that showed toxicity, 78% showed toxicity, and the remaining 12% were non-toxic. For Chironomus, we have this number of samples, 67% were toxic. But if you take all of these together, the sum of the samples, both toxic and non-toxic, and then get the proportion of those which were toxic, it's 89%. It's just a mathematical phenomenon that this is a higher proportion than these individually.
Chris, could I look at it that 89% of these samples were toxic to either Hylala or Chironomus?
Yes.
Okay. That makes sense, and that's something that Michael Johnson whispered to me earlier that made sense.
Okay, very good. And then I think it was Mr. Gatto, it was also you earlier who had a question about those US EPA benchmarks, and are there other benchmarks? Yes, there are other benchmarks, but what we showed on those graphs were the most protective. We used the aquatic life benchmarks, which are the most protective, because that's what we're trying to protect, at least one of the things, is the aquatic life benchmark. So I'll go then to Mr. Young's question about the neonics and pyrethroids. So here is, with respect to our justification for including the neonicotinoids and the pyrethroids in the sampling, the neonicotinoid use in Santa Barbara and Monterey counties for this is active ingredient applied in 2010 was 43,251. In 2014, it was 70,824 pounds applied in these two watersheds. So we see an increase. For the pyrethroids, we see the same pattern, a 46,638 active ingredient applied in 2010. And in 2014, it increased to 70,378 pounds applied. When we take a look then at the chlorpyrifosdiazin and malathion, which are the organophosphates that we are currently monitoring for, we see a decreasing trend in 2010 from 302,507 pounds to 137,147 pounds in 2014. So we interpret this, at least in part, to show that we have an increasing use in neonicotinoids and pyrethroid in active ingredient applied. Now, when we take a look at the toxicity indicators that are sensitive to the neonics to the neonicotinoids and the pyrethroids. We see toxicity above this aquatic life benchmark, which is the US EPA benchmark of 1.05 micrograms per liter. All these samples above this red dashed line are toxic. And so we have imidacloprid, which is a neonicotinoid, in Orca Creek, which Mr. Anderson was referring to earlier, showing toxicity above the benchmark, which is caused by the imidacloprid. When you take a look at tenbiliterol sulfate for the pyrethroid, bifenthrin, which is commonly used on strawberries, we also have concentrations that are above this US EPA benchmark, that is benchmark for aquatic life. In addition to that, as Mr. Anderson indicated, I didn't show you this graph earlier, or this information earlier. This is neonicotinoid use sales in 2014-2015. So the graphs and the tables that I showed you earlier was all information, all data up to 2014. That included DPR data as well as pesticide use report data, which only goes up to 2014. But what about 2015 and on? So what this shows, at least in California wide, clothinidine, imidacloprid, and dinotefuran, which are three neonicotinoids, which you can see in 2000 for the clothinidine. In 2014, we had 20,916 pounds of active ingredient applied. Up in 2015, that went up to 119,731, an increase of 472%. Imidacloprid, we have over 542,000 pounds applied, compared to 791, an increase in 46% in 1 year. And the dinotefuran, we have 13,000, up to 750,000 from 2014 to 2015. That's an increase of 470%. So we certainly have an increased use in the neonicotinoids, not only in Central Coast, but also within the state. We also have evidence to suggest that it is causing toxicity, as with these indicator species that we're now taking a look at, Coronimus, which is included in the amended MRPs. Here is a graph, a couple of graphs, showing the pounds of neonicotinoid use trends in California. This is in California. As you can see, from 1994 to 2014, the pounds applied has risen dramatically in California of imidacloprid, which is one of the neonicotinoids that we have included in the amended MRPs. And this is the number of applications. Finally, if you take a look at the clopyrifos and diazinon use trend, which is what we have been monitoring in the non-amended MRPs, this is Monterey County use of clopyrifos and diazinon. We can see a drop in use in the active ingredients applied from 2004 to 2013. So given this information, we believe that there is an increased use in neonicotinoids, pyrethroids, a decreased use in clopyrifos and diazinon, and increased toxicity to Coronimus, which is sensitive to the neonicotinoids, as well as Hylella, which is sensitive to pyrethroids.
Okay, thank you. Could the staff issue a 13267 letter, basically, to accomplish the same thing?
They could, but that's basically what they've done by having the executive officer amend the monitoring and reporting program. It's the same statute, the same standards for.
There is statutory authority separate from the permit and the MRP.
They can do it within the permit or separately from the permit. The other thing to keep in mind is that because this is a waiver, the board through its executive officer is required to have a monitoring program that can evaluate the effectiveness of the program. And so if you're not going to monitor constituents that have seen in some cases a 470% increase in the face of known toxicity, then there has to be some other way to evaluate the effectiveness of the waiver's provisions for controlling toxicity.
Mr. Scher's comments, I thought were helpful, and that you know, where there's dates that can be adjusted. I think that's easy stuff that we could be doing and should work out, you know, with anybody. You know, it doesn't really affect monitoring.
Right. And we concur. This is more broadly discussed and more appropriate for the subsequent item 12 and the draft 3.0, and we concur with I think the bulk of what Mr. Scheer said on those.
Kay, Mercer, I just have some quick questions for you. When you mention a cost for a client at $63,000, you know, it's hard for me. I mean, that's a lot of money, but I need to put that in context of the size of the ranch, the farm, you know, revenue being generated. And I'm not asking you to do that and to disclose that. But it's hard for me to put that into context of, is this a true burden or not to somebody, other than it being a large dollar amount.
So
in the abstract.
I understand what you're saying, and that it is difficult to find those numbers. However, from the grower's perspective, he has a Tier 3 ranch, which means it's greater than 500 acres. This is just one compliance requirement. He also has to do individual surface water monitoring, and he has to do a water quality buffer plan, as well as the total nitrogen applied and all of the other compliance. When you look at his cost on a per acre basis compared to all of the other growers, and there's only 56 farmer ranches out of about 4,500 farms or ranches that are Tier 3 on the Central Coast. So, and we have one farmer, well, he has two Tier 3 farms or ranches. So you could divide that number by two, and it is approximately 1,200 acres, right? And when you look at the amount of money that he's having to spend compared to all of the other farms or ranches on a per acre basis, it is so disproportional to the actual water quality improvement that there's an incredible inequity. Yes, $63,000 is a lot of money, but now we have to add all the other stuff, which I'm hoping that I can do that analysis before the Ag Waiver 3.0 comment period is done to say, you know, there is not a true nexus here between the amount of money that Tier 3 growers are having to spend. And the real reason I focused on the INMP is because the growers are now being asked to report annually, whereas they were being asked to report every 4 years. So now we are looking at these costs of being greater than $25,000 per year for ranch every year, at least that much. And this doesn't include the cost for resubmission, because the Tier 3 growers, because they're generating data that, and if there's a problem, they have to resubmit and write technical reports or write additional reports. And so those costs are actually escalating. And there's this inequity. Quite honestly, there's a lot of growers who are not enrolled. And so now we have 56 farms or ranches that have incurring these costs, and yet there's a lot of ranchers that aren't even enrolled. And so there seems to be an incredible inequity in terms of how much growers are being asked to pay if they're Tier 3.
Well, I would agree with her that just solely based on the size of a ranch, using that as a criteria, which we have used because it's objective, I have questioned in the past what that relationship is to threat to water quality. I mean, you could have many farms at over 500 acres that are just top-notch BMP implementers doing everything that they need to do, and you could have 1,000 small ranches at 25 acres that are just dropping the ball left and right. And which of the two groups is really presenting a greater risk to water quality? We're not going to answer that today, but it's something that, you know, as we move forward with these changes down the line, I think we really need to be fine-tuning our approach to this. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
For that. I would agree that, you know, Nathaniel raised this, that, you know, the data probably, you know, we need to be keeping in mind that we're a public agency, and as much as we can make data available for the public so that it can be reviewing how we're making our decisions and ensuring that the waiver provisions are being adhered to, I just think that that makes sense, striving to do that as much as we can. Last question, the neonics potentially in groundwater. I don't know, Mr. Shimmick, if that report actually says that there's data showing neonics in groundwater, but I'm wondering if we do any of the groundwater sampling that we're involved with or the state is, are they considering adding neonics? Or do they currently?
Not to my knowledge on both of those questions, but we can talk with the groundwater ambient monitoring and assessment program that does basin level analysis, and we can talk with them. We actually have a call, I think, teed up with them in the next week. We participate in sort of a guide group for that program. That's at the state board level. It's referred to as GAMMA.
Mr. Shimmick, do you know the answer to that question? If you could quickly tell me.
Imidacloprid has not been found in the SURF database in groundwater. Their sample size is 34, so it's a very small sample size.
In which area of the state?
I don't know.
Okay.
But it is listed in the list of chemicals with potential to contaminate groundwater.
Okay.
And that is in the report. I'm actually going to be talking about that in items not on the agenda.
Thank you. No further comments.
Thank you. Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. And I just have a really brief question. Thank you to my fellow board members for covering a number of issues that I think we need clarity on. And thank you to the stakeholders who came forward today to help us look at this MRP at this point and consider where we stand, given what we know and given what we anticipate coming forward with the new order. I just have one question, and that came up regarding the comparison of 2016, 2017, 18, and 19 in terms of what we anticipate for the monitoring requirements. And Mr. Robertson, you mentioned in particular that 2019, and it would be a year where many of the required monitoring from 17 and 18 would not be repeated. And I want to ask you what the reasoning is for those requirements being dropped during 2019. I'm assuming that's not presenting a gap, but that there's some technical and potentially some other factors that come into making that decision.
And I'm going to hand over to Chris Rose.
Good morning, Dr. Hunter. Yes, so you are correct.
Chris,
the amended MRPs are 2017.
Do we want to save this for the next item? Because that's really the focus of the next item is
right.
The broader MRP and draft order 3.0.
We're drifting into the
right,
next item here.
Right.
So.
Blurring the boundaries between items here.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to understand in terms of how adaptive monitoring and data we're collecting is being projected relative to 2017. So I guess, I mean, I can wait for the answer and if it makes sense to take that question forward. But I just, I think there's some effort to consider costs, but I think there are also some other considerations about why 2019 would be a year when there would be less data collection.
And will you write down a note, as will I, to address that in the next item too? There is actually a nexus to perhaps why we're not pushing for 2016 requirements into 2017. You know, I mean, that's the analog, I guess, question there. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is we conferred with the board in July. The board sent, by my measure, unambiguous information to staff about its expectations for monitoring in 2017. There should be, and these are the things we expect to see in it. And that's what you see reflected in the amended MRP signed in August. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Then we'll wait to hear the answer until the next item.
I don't necessarily have any questions because most of them have been addressed, but I did just want to make some comments regarding some of the issues that I'm a bit more sensitive towards, and I do think that often thinking about the cost of compliance and what it means for some of our stakeholders serving in local government, you know, we're also subject to many changing regulations, and so I am sensitive in particular to that issue, and definitely we want to ensure the public health and safety of all of our community members. And so these goals are, in effect, a way to help us achieve and ensure the safety of all of our community members. But I do think, you know, without sort of a neater way of quantifying what the cost is for our various stakeholders, that does pose a lot and a large complexity in helping us achieve our water quality goals with some of these processes that we're attempting to adapt for future implementation. But of course, you know, it's a matter of continuing to keep trying to sort of gauge and attempt to quantify what that actual cost is in terms of helping us achieve full compliance with some of these changing regulations. Also, a little bit of what I heard with some of the comments had to do with this administrative adoption of these changing MRPs alongside conversations. Also, as you can see in our agenda, we are having back-to-back conversations, so I understand a little bit of the confusion in terms of the process for this administrative adoption of new MRPs to be monitored and measured, but then at the same time, you know, having a separate public process for the new ag order. And so I understand, in terms of, some of the public process and some of the hearings that we've had, to also have included, conversations around these potential changes around our MRP. So just a couple of things that I'm sensitive to and that I did hear concerns about from both board members, but then also, of course, our stakeholders in the community.
Thank you. And I have myself just two, three brief questions. One is a suggestion, Chris, is that when you do have tables where total statistical number appears to be a little bit at odd, which you called it a mathematical phenomenon, would suggest to list the sampled population specifically, because then it turns it more into a direct correlation of data. Because in one category, you could have had 500 samples as a sample population, in the other category, 20. So I think that in the future would help a little bit demystify the results. When we talked earlier about, I heard the term treadmill, and I don't quite correlate treadmill with, DPR listing. And I think what needs to be remembered is the large amount of DPR listed pesticides available in the toolbox. So, for example, you know, what's the number? Because, you know, we list quite a few multi-syllable compounds here. How many, if we look at the DPR list, I mean, how many pesticides are available to agriculture? And, you know, rough number is okay. And if you don't have the answer, we probably have a PCA here in the room who can give that number.
Yes, sir.
Did you give it earlier?
So, no, are you asking me how many are actually on the list as available?
Yeah.
Well, that's, I don't know. Many.
Right. Many. And that's the point. It's the many. And when I say many, we're not talking about, you know, a dozen. So I think that, you know, we need to always revert back to, you know, what's called sometimes the 80-20 rule is looking at the most critical ones. And I heard the term earlier from Mr. Shimmick saying adaptive, and I think that's spot on, is rather than trying to put everything but the kitchen sink to track, is to be adaptive. And we need to be able to, you know, move around as we see a change. You know, we recalibrate our direction. So I'm comfortable with that approach. I heard a comment from Kay in regard to, you know, growers not being enrolled, and you know I know in previous months, you know, we had a list of enrollees, and we're getting, I think, pretty accurate in knowing who, you know, who has submitted ENOIs and who has not. Could I get a little response on this suggestion that we do have still growers who are basically ignoring, you know, this 2.0 ag order?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Charwolf. Yes, we are continuing our efforts to get those non-enrolled growers to enroll. We just sent out, I think it was 50 letters a couple of weeks ago, in which 25% of them enrolled within 10 days. As the board probably knows, if you look on our website, you can see that for those people who we did contact, who we identified as non-enrollees, and required them to enroll, who didn't enroll, now they are paying big fines. So we are moving forward. We want the grower community to know that we understand this is an issue, and we are moving forward, and we do act on it.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. And then lastly, if you can confirm that to me, Mr. Robertson, is that when we'll look at 3.0, and we're going, you know, we still have comment period on 3.0 until the beginning of next year, then we will have debates over 3.0. And this will, you know, and then the final decision will be made in March 2017, that at that time, with additional information, the sampling requirements, both for surface and groundwater, still could be modified, whereas this MRP 2017 is not locked in. So there's still, in 2017, at the final hearing, there could be modifications made both to the surface and groundwater monitoring program, including what is taking place in 2017.
Correct. That's absolutely correct. The draft MRP that covers the proposed three-year term of 3.0 includes 2017. The rub there is it the later we get, the more challenging it makes it to respond to changes in 2017. So if we make changes in March of 2017, it's challenging for the cooperative monitoring program to respond to those changes specific to that calendar year. That's the challenge created for.
But we basically have an overlap between, you know, this MRP and right. and potential changes next
right.
year.
Correct.
Okay.
That
just
option
wanted to
still
clarify
exists.
That.
Right.
All right. So what I'd like now is for us to take a 60-minute recess, and we will have a closed session. So we will reconvene at...
Dr. Wolf?
Yes.
So to wrap up that item, item 11, the board needs to give the executive officer direction.
Yes.
And then make the determination.
Two things. When we reconvene, this will be an opportunity for staff to provide comments
closing.
on the speakers and added clarification, and then after that, you know, the board will look at the direction. So we will reconvene at 1:30, and we have a closed session, correct?
We're going to reconvene here at 2 o'clock because we have a 90-minute break that includes a closed session.
Oh, I misread 60 minutes. Thank you for straightening
that's combined
me up.
Lunch and closed session.
All right, so nine. So we will come back at 2. All right, so it'll be a long lunch for all of you.
And Chair Wolf, just so that we can put it on the record that the closed session, the board will be meeting in closed session to discuss pending litigation. It's authorized by Government Code Section 11126E2A. And the items at closed session will be number 6 and 10 from the agenda. That's the Zamora and Rava Ranches cases.